Crosswires, navigating news with faith with Father Daniel Brandenburg, LC, and Chris McDonald. Crosswires, today's secular news stories viewed through a Catholic lens, from a layman's questions and a clergyman's reaction. Now, here's Chris and Father Daniel.
Father Daniel, how are you? Happy Chris. Advent to you.
Hey, Chris, it's great to be in Advent. What a beautiful time of preparation for Christmas.
And we've got our Holy Day of Obligation coming up here Monday.
That's right. Yes. So why do you call it a Holy Day of Obligation?
What do you call it?
Well, I think it's a great opportunity. Holy Day of Opportunity. I mean, think about it this way. We get to go to Mass. We get to receive the Creator of the universe an extra time during the week. And it's a really special blessing.
Amen. We'll start this week's topics with a New York Times Magazine article about the lesser discussed ways antidepressants affect teenagers' sexual development.
Okay.
So SSRIs, those are the, that's one
What's
type
that
of...
What's that stand for?
That's serotonin reuptake inhibitors.
Okay.
This one type of antidepressant. So post-SSRI sexual dysfunction is a condition in which the side effects from these serotonin uptake reuptake inhibitors persist even after you stop taking the medication. Side effects include...
And how long does that last, the negative effect?
Not sure, but the side effects include loss of sexual desire, arousal, numbness in one's sexual anatomy, and erectile dysfunction. So in the article, those who took SSRIs during their teenage years or younger also, interestingly, report that they no longer experience the typical teenage crush. Roughly 2 million 12 to 17-year-olds in the U.S. are taking SSRIs. With side effects like these, is it any wonder that, you know, so many young people have trouble finding meaningful social connections?
I think it's certainly one factor. And you have to ask in the first place, why are they taking these antidepressants? I think that's the bigger question here, because when you and I were growing up, and it was just, no one was on antidepressants.
No
one. It's like an unknown. And how is it that young people are struggling so much now with depression? I think it's because we've been messing with a normal childhood, you know, letting people go out and play and have fun and actually socialize with other people. Now we have, you know, kids staying inside on social media or playing video games. They're not out on playgrounds. They're not socializing in the same way. Someone was joking with me yesterday to say, hey, you ever seen those, like a bunch of teenagers sitting around in a circle all on their phones simultaneously? They're not talking with each other. They're not communicating. And that's not human. And I think when we alter the normal way of human interactions and the growth process, we're going to have negative side effects.
Well, and by messing with normal childhood, we're now messing more with normal childhood. So we're messing with
exactly.
normal childhood, putting people on antidepressants, and then they're no longer experiencing the typical teenage crush. I mean,
that's crazy.
Everybody remembers, you know, how crazy you got, you know, over a girl or a guy that, you know, nowadays you kind of wish you could have those types of emotions, you know, but as teenagers, those crushes were so
well. Even
the
normal
of
development of sexual arousal, and we all know we've gone through that period of puberty, and it brings struggles and challenges with it. But it's also part of the normal process of growing up and maturing.
Right.
And when you fall in love with someone, then you're willing to make sacrifices. And when we have a society which is no longer able to love, no longer to sacrifice oneself, that becomes very problematic.
Well, I just think it's interesting because you have the physical manifestation of something like erectile dysfunction in teenagers, no less. My
gosh.
Which
is crazy.
But then the fact that you don't experience any teenage crush, it just blows my mind.
Yeah, that is pretty crazy. Gosh.
Crossed wires. If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
In what is called the Turing test, developed in 1950 to answer the question, can machines think? Mathematician Alan Turing designed a test which basically was, can you have a conversation with it? To determine, it was his way to determine whether behavior was imitation or an internal state of consciousness. By that standard, today we would be surrounded by conscious machines, and there's even an emerging field of AI welfare devoted to figuring out if and when we must care about machines and give them rights. So recent research has been seriously considering the possibility that animals too have consciousness. We've talked about this subject before, but in April of 2024, a group of 40 scientists at a conference in New York proposed the New York Declaration on Animal Consciousness that was subsequently signed by over 500 scientists and philosophers. The declaration says consciousness is realistically possible in all animals, citing behaviors such as crabs that tend their wounds as that indicating consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
So after reading this, I was thinking that all they're doing is really pointing out levels of intelligence, not consciousness.
Well, it depends on how you define consciousness, Chris. It boils down to that. And I really don't have any problem in saying that animals are conscious because they have an awareness. They have awareness of their surroundings, awareness of their own identity. There's nothing novel in declaring that animals have consciousness, as long as, depending on how you define consciousness. I think the bridge is when you start to look at intelligence and the immortal soul of human being. There's a line that's crossed, which is very different. Human intelligence is distinctive from animal intelligence. And, you know, you can talk with 1,000 philosophers and scientists, and they will recognize these differences. So on the area of consciousness, I really don't have any problem recognizing animals have consciousness. But,
right, but is it different to behave as though you're conscious without actually having consciousness? I mean, that's what I think's going on here. It's just intelligence versus consciousness.
Well, that's the distinction between vegetable life and animal life. Animal
but there's
life
no intelligence behavior of a vegetable.
Correct. Right. No, definitely not. But it does have behavior for self-preservation. I mean, that's why if you watch vegetables or plants in slow motion, they will turn towards the sun. They will turn away from objects which are causing them damage. So there is some sort of...
So they're acting like they're conscious, but that's really just a level. I mean, it's a very...
Reactive, very base level.
Base level
totally.
Intelligence, I guess, is what you would say.
I don't know that I would call that intelligence within plants. I think when you get into animal life, that's when you start bridging the gap to a certain degree of intelligence. But then the distinction between all animal life and human life and human intelligence, there's a huge gap there. And that's where you start the creation of tools. And then sometimes scientists will point to, oh, monkeys will use tools. And they do. Dogs will use tools. I mean, dolphins use tools.
Well, trees use tools. Oak trees drop their acorns to get the squirrel to then disperse it so that they can, I mean, that's using the squirrel as a tool.
In a broad sense, you could say that, yeah. But the way that human beings utilize tools is different from any other animal. So again, we can go into these distinctions from a philosophical level, but there's a difference when you start talking, the difference between animal, vegetable, and human life.
Crossed Wires. If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Crosswires. Related to our last topic, we've spoken previously about people wanting to grant certain nature rights, legal rights. In this grant of rights push, a publication called Current Affairs argues that wild animals deserve rights. The author states that because they are sentient and have recognizable social behaviors and emotions, that we as humans don't have the right to manage them. He proposes a principle called just preservation that advocates for impartiality between species with equitable distribution of natural resources. So as you know, the Catholic Church teaches that man has dominion over animals and that they are ultimately destined for the common good of humanity. Therefore, their welfare is placed below ours. So if you're an atheist and you reject all sectarian bases for teachings regarding this matter, what other basis would you use to convince individuals who hold these types of views?
Well, I saw a very similar proposal coming from a herd of zebra in Africa. They had proposed rights for themselves, too.
The right to be black and white rather than white and black?
Yes. Yeah. Sorry, I've just put it out a really ridiculous example because... these are human beings that are proposing this. Now, I think whenever you talk about rights, one of the things we get wrong in our society today is that we talk only in a lopsided manner. We talk all about these rights, but what about the balancing side of that, which is the responsibilities? So I think a really easy, sniff test for this is like whenever someone's talking about rights, it's like, well, what are the responsibilities that come into play? And if they're not equal responsibilities, there's probably not a basis for rights to begin with. So I think let's talk about, well, wild animal responsibilities. What responsibilities do they have? None. I mean, they have, in a broad sense, we could say they have responsibilities to their offspring. In a broad sense, we could say that they have responsibilities towards, you know, eating certain plants or maintaining a certain balance in nature. But they don't have responsibilities.
No, I totally agree. And I like that sniff test about, you know, what responsibilities you have. But I'm asking like a broader question here for somebody who claims to be truly atheist.
Mm-hmm.
Most of what we, most of the rights and laws that we have really do, when you come down to it, they come from our
natural
ancestors
law.
In religion and ultimately natural law, which is a theological concept.
It's a theological concept, but it's based on human nature. And this goes to the principle that, you know, it's not true because the Catholic Church teaches it, but because it's true, the Catholic Church teaches it.
All right. Well, I was looking at some of the other rationales that might be used to mm-hmm. justify this that are not theologically based, which, you know, let me just talk about them real quick. And I think some of them actually are. So Immanuel Kant and John Locke, the philosophers, they argued that since humans possess capacity for abstract reason and free will, that makes them superior to other life forms. Because we can reason, we have higher intrinsic value compared to non-rational beings. So that's their, but that to me is like a repackaging of,
yeah, and that's basic philosophy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's just a repackaging of what God told man in Genesis that, you know, we're giving you dominion over.
Yeah, you could say it's a repackaging, but neither one of them are coming from a religious standpoint. I mean, you know, John Locke definitely cannot be, you know, categorized as a Christian.
Right. But I would say ultimately, though, it sounds like Genesis, you know, even though similar, he's not. You know, yeah. Okay. So then the principle of utilitarian.
That's because there's an underlying reality.
It's called
in
the natural
nature.
Law. the natural law exists, strong. Whether you acknowledge it or not.
Exactly.
All right. So the principle of utilitarianism would say that the most ethical action is the one that maximizes the overall well-being. But again, mm-hmm. this assumes the overall well-being you're talking about is the overall well-being of humans.
Generally, yes.
Right.
Although if you take it away from its moorings, you could apply that to animals. But definitely in its original formulation, it's always from the vantage point of human
right.
beings.
Okay. So anthropocentrism is the belief that humans are the center right. of moral and ethical concern mm-hmm. and that human value is derived from the capacity to build civilizations, create art, record history, develop science, etc.
Sure.
So this unique ability gives us our standing to control beasts. Okay, that would be it's just another way of recognizing the hierarchy.
Sure.
So I was thinking about this and I was and
oh,
I
that's always a dangerous
I
thing.
Know, right. And so I want to know your thoughts about a different approach, a simpler approach that would just use the concept of that nature abhors a vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
And so by that, I mean that, so like human intervention in agriculture is bringing order, more order to a disorderly state.
Yes.
Okay. And so this order is our dominion over animals and therefore our supreme rights over them is justified
by
us.
Don't forget, the rights come with responsibilities.
With responsibilities, of course. Yeah, it's not just that we...
Which is where we're talking about, you know, a healthy ecology and the standing of the church. Is, you know, we have a stewardship over creation. We have a responsibility to care for what God has given us.
Well, what about this as a, you know, a philosophy where the, you know, filling the vacuum with order?
Mm-hmm.
Because if you leave nature to its... own devices, you know, there
it's
are certain...
entropy. It's the law of entropy. Things start to fall apart.
Exactly.
Become disordered.
Well, not necessarily fall apart,
overgrown.
Right? I mean, you know, if a forest will encroach on the meadow that exists until there's now no meadow and it's a forest,
mm-hmm.
right? So it fills the vacuum. And so if you step back as a philosophy and say that, you know, man is superior and has the right because we are the ones who can create the order.
Mm-hmm. We do that. We do create order in that way, we participate in God's creative work because he brings order out of chaos.
And ultimately, really, it just comes down to you have to recognize that there is a natural law.
Yeah. Yeah. And people who are not people of faith can recognize there's a natural law. I think the people who really struggle with natural law are the ones who are trying to create an alternative reality, which doesn't exist and it flies in the face of the facts.
Crossed Wires. If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Crosswires. Quantum teleportation has moved from science fiction to laboratory reality.
Really?
In a milestone experiment, a team of physicists from universities in Germany successfully sent information between two separate light-emitting devices by teleporting the quantum state of light rather than sending the ordinary signal through a fiber like we do
sure.
normally. So this feat was made possible thanks to the phenomenon known as quantum entanglement. Mm-hmm. So unlike Star Trek's teleporters, quantum teleportation doesn't actually move physical objects. Instead, it's more like scanning a document so perfectly that the scan becomes the original, while the copy automatically shreds itself. So the information transfers to a new location, and the original vanishes in the process.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so researchers started with a single light particle. They then performed a special measurement combining this particle with one half of an entangled pair. When this measurement works, the state of the original particle instantly transfers to the other half of the entangled pair, even though the particle might be on the other side of the universe.
Hmm.
The original particle state gets destroyed while the distant particle becomes an exact copy. So why am I bringing this up? So even though this experiment, when they were transmitting light photons, which are not matter, mm-hmm. right? It's not like you and I. What if it became possible to teleport yourself like this, where you are a copy of yourself? You erase yourself and the exact copy on the other side of the universe is now in existence. What happens to your soul? Like, I want to know what your...
Gosh, this is kind of like mind-bending,
right?
To bring science fiction into reality here. No, it's fascinating, and I think this is a really interesting elements for continued research. But what happens to the soul in that case? I mean, if it's an exact copy, and if God permits that, I guess your soul is now transmutated somewhere else. I'd have to give it a lot more thought.
Right?
But yeah, let's cross that bridge when we come to it.
Well, I don't think we're going to cross that bridge in our lifetime, at least
probably
with matter.
Not.
But it is now scientifically possible. I mean, we will get mm-hmm. there eventually.
Well, what I find really interesting in the whole concept of quantum entanglement is the possibility of it. It gives a scientific grounding for what people have thought for a long time, like where mothers will all of a sudden have a sense that their child is in danger and they're 1,000 miles away and they start praying for them. This concept of quantum entanglement really gives us that scientific grounding for things that we've experienced in life, where there's like the sixth sense that something's going on or that this person's in need. And I think God has a way of revealing new and fascinating things to us about his creation that we were oblivious to before. Just like in prior generations, they discovered germs, and that was the foundation for why people get sick. Now we're discovering new things about reality, which God has created. It's always been there. But this is a fascinating thing about science. God has given us that ability to peer in new ways and discover the majesty of what he's created.
Who else knows what's out there, right?
Exactly. This is why the church has always been in favor of scientific research and really looking into the deeper reality that is behind what God has given us.
Crossed Wires. If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Crosswires. An op-ed in the Wall Street Journal in response to the election of Mamdani in New York City discusses the historical implications of anarchy in politics. The article draws parallels of anarchy to achieve goals from the Bolshevik Revolution to the Occupy Wall Street protests. So I have no doubt that there's a certain truth to the Machiavellian idea that governments sometimes create problems that they can then solve and take credit for it.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if that's not what's going to happen here in New York City with Mamdani now at the helm. So I think in reality, it's unlikely he's going to follow through with some of the threats that he's made about, like defunding the police and such.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
But I have to say that since I don't have to live through it, I'm kind of rooting for it to happen.
And Chris, that's terrible. Come on.
Well, and so for New York City to get what they've asked for, I mean, so his first question, is it wrong for me to feel this way?
Okay. I have to admit, I'm a little bit with you on that one. I mean, people get the politicians that they vote for, and then they have to live through the consequences of that. The problem is that long term, that begins to shift culture and people's ability to recognize things that are actually really problematic. I mean, look at Venezuela. Or any of the failed states throughout Latin America, you start a downward cycle of just, destruction of the infrastructure of society. And there's no hope for anyone going forward. And unfortunately, that's a bit of the detritus of socialism around the world, is it promises great things, but then when you start putting into practice, it starts to deteriorate the infrastructure of society and destroy the family.
Well, I mean, ultimately, I think this is the end goal is political. This is a means to political control. So if you look at this was in the headlines this week that the state of Massachusetts energy costs there have ballooned. Mm-hmm. Okay, like they have many places, but particularly in Massachusetts. And so when the governor was asked recently about it, she blamed the current Trump administration's tariffs on steel and aluminum for increasing energy infrastructure costs.
That makes no sense whatsoever.
But then they played an audio of her during her 2022 gubernatorial campaign, where she campaigned on the back of and bragged about how, as attorney general, she blocked a couple of natural gas pipelines from attempting to be built in the state. And right. She now, you know, recognizes that they need to
increase the cost of the energy.
So it's an example of create the problem and then solve it. Right? She's now in favor of these pipelines, you know, that she campaigned on the back of blocking. So,
right.
But I'd like to talk about a little anarchy subplot that I've been thinking about. So
let me ask a question of you first, though, Chris. Were you an anarchist when you were a teenager?
No, I was. No, I was not an anarchist, but I was.
Were you a rebel?
I was a misbehavior.
I can see a little bit of that in you, Chris.
Not an anarchist.
Okay, good.
All right. So the toleration of public smoking of pot, I think, mm-hmm. is a subtle anarchy appetizer. So public consumption of pot exists independent of the legal status of the drug. So like here in Georgia, marijuana is illegal, but if you're driving down the interstate, which I always do with my windows open, no matter the temperature, you invariably, it could be 6 a.m., but you smell weed.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's from people driving in the cars next to you.
That's right.
So imagine if you are always driving down the freeway with a cocktail visible in your hand, how long would it take, do you think, for you to be pulled over and, you know, ticketed, mm-hmm. right? Or thrown in jail. So I think it's comical that in every city in the U.S., almost every city, I think in Vegas, you probably can walk around with a beer, but it's illegal to drink alcohol on the street.
Hmm.
Right.
And well, I didn't know that.
And well, yeah, there's a prohibition.
I'll have to stop toting around that beer with me.
Yeah. You can't have almost every city has an open container law. There might be certain districts within a city where you're allowed to walk around with an open beer, you know,
just outside a bar or something.
Right. But generally, if you walk around with an open beer, you will be ticketed.
Hmm. Okay.
So, but you can't find a city now in the U.S. where, I mean, there's nowhere where you can't walk around and not smell the skunk smell of marijuana, and nobody is doing anything about it. It's like de facto legal. So there's this absurdity. I remember being at a Little League baseball game and somebody just flipping out at somebody who was smoking a cigarette in the parking lot, and the, you know, tobacco smoke was wafting over to the dugout. I mean, this person just was flipped out, but, you know, don't say anything about.
Yeah, it's kind of bizarre. When you think about it, because tobacco, I mean, yeah, tobacco it has consequences, but the consequences now are coming out more and more clearly as the science is catching up with it about the side effects of cannabis and of marijuana. I mean, this is really problematic for our society. But there's been a campaign against tobacco and there's been a campaign for cannabis. And we see the results of those campaigns, publicity campaigns in our society.
Well, I read this other op-ed about the legalization of marijuana, and this was a guy who was with the National Review who was in favor of the legalization of marijuana, but he says it's a good idea with bad consequences, and he says the bad consequences is this smell. This is everywhere. So I think there's something deeper at work here with this acceptance of the smell of marijuana everywhere. So I think it's either a reverse broken windows policy, you know what I'm talking about when
yes.
I say, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's you push the boundaries a little to expand what people will tolerate, and you just keep pushing and pushing.
See how far you can take it.
Or I think there's something, the constituency of folks who are smoking pot on a regular basis, according to the National Library of Medicine, is that it's way more common among young and racial minority populations, as well as respondents with low socioeconomic status. I wonder if there's not some fear of confronting and, you know, civil unrest by imposing the laws which already exist, which, you know, if you have a laundromat and it's cranking out these noxious fumes,
someone's going to come to shut it down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're not doing it with marijuana. Why? Are we afraid of the constituents being, you know, civil unrest?
Mm-hmm. That's certainly part of it. I have two brothers who had one used to be a cop and one who just became a cop, and they've had to deal firsthand with people on the street selling drugs and consuming drugs. And it gets to a certain point. My brother, who was a police officer actually here in Atlanta, he quit the force because he just got tired of arresting criminals, putting them into jail, and then they would get out the next day because they had a good lawyer and a lot of money. He said the injustice of the justice system was causing a lot of problems. Now, a lot of this is, there's, it's, there's a broader question, because we're looking at what's going on within our justice system and with our approach as a society to dealing with incarceration. And you have firsthand knowledge of this, Chris, too, because you go on a regular basis to do prison ministry, which is beautiful. My mom did that for a time. That's hard. And you see people who are in that state of incarceration. But we have our system right now is not working well. And part of the overload of the system because of illegal drugs has brought us to the point where people are saying, well, let's just make them legal and we'll make the system easier. But it's not addressing the core issues.
Well, is it what I started with? Is this some sort of political end game around anarchy in little ways?
It's possible. Is this something that could be orchestrated by people? It's possible. Is it something that the powers and principalities that, with St. Paul says, our battle is truly against is working? Possibly. Certainly, we know that some of the side effects of cannabis and of marijuana is that people develop schizophrenia. They become mentally unstable. They become more easily manipulated throughout the rest of their life. So, yeah, I think this is where it's important for us to come back to the, as we talked about in the prior topic, come back to the order that comes from God, an ordered existence where we have our priorities straight, where we don't need to turn to substances to run away from the problems that we have in our world.
It's not funny, but I did laugh when I read that the founder of the Swiss Right to Die organization known as Dignitas has died. How do you think he died?
Euthanasia?
Yeah, by suicide.
Oh, gosh. Well,
Ludwig Minelli founded Dignitas after splitting from an older Swiss assisted dying organization known as Exit because he felt its rules were too restrictive.
Mm.
In a parody that I think you could find on Saturday Night Live, the BBC lauded Minelli in death as someone who, since 1998, helped thousands, quote, thousands of people to die. A great killer of people.
Gosh, you're celebrating that? I saw a similar headline just recently with over 16.
By the way, they didn't say, quote, a great killer. That was my quote.
Oh, that was your quote. Okay. Well, that's pretty macabre.
They lauded him as someone who, you know, who helped thousands of people die.
Yeah, that's terrible. There are over 16,000 people in Canada last year that were euthanized.
I saw that.
So it's just really sad to see what we're coming to. I think we need to come to a greater valuation of the gift of life.
If there's a topic you'd like Father Daniel to address, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Crosswires. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back again next week with a different take on the news.
This has been Crosswires, navigating news with faith, with Father Daniel Brandenburg, LC, and Chris McDonald. Today's secular news stories viewed through a Catholic lens. On AM 1160, The Quest.